On Tech News Today, the FCC votes to approve net neutrality in the United States. Plus, Google may break Google Plus into pieces. And we'll tell you how to spend $75,000 on the next Apple Watch. We've got brilliant journalists from NPR, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and more. So stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, February 26th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. My name is Mike Elgin, and joining us as co-anchor is NPR technology and culture reporter Elise Hugh. And for the last show for now, maybe, Elise, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's really good to be here.
You are in a rapidly abandoned apartment because you are moving to Seoul, Korea on Sunday to become the Seoul bureau chief, the one and only, for NPR.
Seoul
bureau chief. And you'll be covering Japan and Korea, both Koreas, I imagine, although there's not a whole lot of innovation in North Korea. And that is just a killer beat. I'm really excited for you, but we are going to miss you horribly.
I'm going to miss you and all the viewers, too. And so, as I was saying during pre-show, I'll try to pop in now and again.
We appreciate that. You've got tons of fans in the chat room and on the live and also download. So you're welcome anytime. You don't even have to call.
Well, thanks, Mike.
Quick thing of the day. Apple announced an event on March 9th. It's pretty certain that it's going to be the Apple Watch. They'll officially roll it out. They may even launch it that day. There are going to no doubt be lines out the door. This is a big, big event. Nobody knows if it's going to sell big or if it's going to flop. I imagine it'll do at least pretty well. It could be a runaway hit. At least do you have a sense of how well the Apple Watch is going to sell on the market?
Well, just because it is an Apple, just by nature of it being an Apple hardware product, I imagine that it's going to get some sort of like strong media coverage and a lot of interest in the first few days. But whether that is sustainable and sustained depends on the product itself. So I'm eager to check it out.
All right. Wonderful. Well, why don't we jump into the big, big story today? The Federal Communications Commission voted today on net neutrality for the United States after millions of public comments and a rare political victory for the public over intense industry lobbying. The FCC voted to approve net neutrality for the United States. Andrew Fitzgerald is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I'm sorry, it's Drew Fitzgerald, and he joins us now. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, can you briefly talk about what the FCC voted on? I mean, yes, they voted to approve net neutrality, but are there any specifics? Is there any fine print in this vote?
There's a whole lot of fine print. In fact, there's more than 300 pages of fine print to this. This has been a long, long, tortured process, and those who have been following it for many years might remember that this is pretty much the third time that the FCC has tried to make rules around net neutrality, and it's been each time been set back by court challenges and other setbacks like that. This time, it looks like it's going to be challenged in court again, but these are the most aggressive rules we've had in the U.S.
Andrew, what does that mean? So when what are the actual practical implications on consumers when these new net neutrality rules go into effect?
Right. Well, they won't go into effect for a couple months. And again, then after that, they'll be challenged. But there's a couple big points that are new in this. The first is the concept of net neutrality. Again, it's pretty technical, but the whole idea is if your internet service provider gives you access, they can't pick winners and losers. They can't block or prioritize certain traffic for a fee. The two big additions this time are it'll apply to mobile networks, so your AT&T and Verizon service would be bound by these rules. Again, there's a lot of possibilities that could delay that. And the second point is that it'll affect interconnection. If you remember the big fight that Netflix had with a lot of cable companies and Verizon and AT&T. That was over an area even deeper in the internet that has never been regulated by the FCC before, and this would do that.
There are essentially two threats to this ruling. One of them is, as you mentioned, the lawsuit that's coming out. The second one is a future administration, possibly a Republican administration that could have a Republican-dominated FCC, in which case they could overturn this. And this doesn't mean that we have net neutrality forever. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that for now, the FCC has voted to enact these rules. Now, it seems to me that the bigger threat, as far as I can tell, is actually the lawsuit. Because the politics on this, I think, stunned Congress. This is a rare moment where public outcry and a lot of grassroots and a little bit of astroturfing by the industry, but a lot of grassroots involvement and commenting by the public kind of overwhelmed the intense lobbying by the industry that was against net neutrality. And so I would imagine that in a couple of years with another president, another FCC, the politics are still going to be similar. This is a dicey thing, and it could be political suicide, I think, for any administration to back the overturning of net neutrality now that it's been voted in. But what do you think about that perspective?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been really interesting to watch how this has evolved. As you remember, there was one kind of avenue that the FCC was trying to take to put these rules into effect. And that essentially fell apart when the president made a statement and released a video saying that he wanted very simple, plain rules under Title II of the Communications Act, which is a utility-style regulation. But the other point is a future administration, even if this does survive court challenges, could, instead of overturning this, simply just be less aggressive in applying the rules. There's a lot of rules that say that prevent unfair practices that are unjust and unreasonable, but it's up to the agency, which is usually the chairman is appointed by the sitting president. It's up to them to decide what's fair. So a future administration could decide to be less aggressive in going after those types of practices.
So, Drew, assuming that these new regulations do go into effect, is something that we Netflix customers can look forward to is just less buffering then? I mean, I want to know about my buffering.
About buffering, right. Yeah, we all know buffering, especially on Skype sometimes. It's something that you can look forward to on Netflix, although a lot of that was solved because Netflix struck a deal to basically pay for these types of links to Comcast and Verizon. And they did that. They said that at the time that they would rather not do it, but they had to. Honestly, I think the bigger impact you're going to see is a change in how your cell phone operators manage their networks. They've had a lot of leeway to do what they want, and now they're going to be under a microscope.
Now, this vote is especially important for Netflix because Netflix, of course, gobbles up a huge percentage of the national bandwidth. You wrote a really interesting piece about this. Can you talk about what this vote means for Netflix in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Netflix has said there's going to be a complaint process now. So if any website or really any company that runs on the internet has a complaint against a broadband company, they can bring it to the FCC and the FCC will decide whether they're being reasonable. Just the threat of that could be enough to resolve these kinds of disputes on their own. So I think in the future, you will see a lot less buffering caused by this problem with Netflix, with YouTube, with a lot of other issues. But then again, there's the issue of capacity in the first place. It's not going to solve your connection at your home if you don't have a high-speed connection.
Andrew,
and that's the issue, right?
Sorry to cut you off there. Drew, just one final question, which is in a last-minute filing, Google actually raised concerns about the Wheeler plan, which was just voted on. Can you talk a little bit about what Google's concerns were and what the commission did in response?
Absolutely. I mean, this is pretty technical, but Google had the same sort of complaint that AT&T and a few other public interest groups had. And their complaint was basically if the FCC used certain language to define this relationship between cable companies and internet companies, that could backfire and that other countries, especially in Europe, is the hint, could turn that around and say, well, we're going to have a tax on YouTube. We're going to have a tax on Netflix, any big bandwidth user. That's exactly what these companies don't want. And that was, as best we can understand, taken out of the language.
Interesting.
Of the rules today.
The power of Google. What are you going to do? Drew Fitzgerald is at WSJ.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Drew Fitzgerald. Thank you so much for joining us, Drew.
Thank you.
Tell us what you think about the FCC's big vote today. Send email to tnt@twit.tv, and we want to hear from you and find out what you think. All right, well, we got some more news for you coming up, actually more Google news. But first, let's talk about Blue Apron, one of our sponsors today. Blue Apron is such a fantastic service. I subscribe, and I get a big box once a week and rip open that box. And inside is everything I need to make three delicious, better-than-restaurant-quality meals. It has these really nicely designed cards that show you all the ingredients so you can sort of put everything out on the table. And then on the other side of the card is step-by-step instructions for how to make really brilliant, brilliant food. And, you know, it's one of the things that I find stressful about cooking is just the mental, like, you know, I'm not a really experienced cook. So it's like using a recipe from a recipe book or something like that. It's stressful to do multiple parts of an entire meal. But with Blue Apron, the way they do it, they time it, the whole thing as an integrated whole. So it's like super, super easy. It's like 5 or 6 steps. And you've got this incredible meal. And every time that I make it, my wife is super impressed. My kids are super impressed when they've tried it. My son actually has his own subscription. And it's really, really great. And this sounds like it'd be really expensive because they're sending you this really fresh, high-quality food in just the right portions. But it's only $10 per meal per person. It's actually less than that. And it sounds like it might be sort of high calorie, but no, each meal is between 500 and 700 calories per serving. And it's so delicious, you'd never know that it's really low calorie. Blue Apron is just great. It's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Don't forget the /twit part. That's two meals free just for going to blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for that. Well, before we go, there's the dish that I made. That's the chicken dish that I made recently with mashed potatoes. Man, that was good. So just go to blueapron.com/twit, and we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. Well, we've got another huge story today. One of the most powerful people in Silicon Valley is Google Senior Vice President Sundar Pichai. After 11 years at Google, he's been gradually put in charge of an increasing array of products, and today he's responsible for Android, Google Chrome, the Chrome OS, Chromebooks, Google Drive, Google Docs, Gmail, Search, Maps, and Google Plus. This week, Forbes San Francisco Bureau Chief Miguel Helft sat down with Pichai for a rare interview, and he's sitting down with us today for another rare interview. Welcome to you, Miguel.
Thanks very much.
Now, Google Plus was launched and spearheaded by Vic Gundotra, of course, who left Google about 10 months ago. What did Pichai tell you about what's coming up for Google Plus?
Well, there's two things. The first one is he sort of clarified something that the folks at Google internally have said, perhaps to save face on the fact that the usage on Google Plus is not great. But they're saying Google Plus serves two purposes. One is the social network, as you think about it, and in that respect, we know it hasn't been a runaway hit by any stretch of the imagination. The other element for them is that it allowed Google to offer its services to people who were logged into the service, a common login across whether it's Gmail, YouTube, you name it. And that was very important for Google. And Sundar sort of made the point that, you know, that second part was perhaps even more important for them, and it worked out quite well. Now, the bit of news that I thought was really interesting is I started asking about Google Plus. We haven't seen a lot of innovation on the product side. And yet there are some things that people seem to like the Google Hangouts, which is a communication service, Google Photos, which is part of Google Plus. But a lot of people don't use it just because it's part of Google Plus. And what Sundar said was that likely going forward, those things are going to be broken apart. So there will still be a Google Plus live stream or stream or news feed or whatever you want to call it. And then Hangouts and Photos are probably going to be standalone products within the Google ecosystem.
So is there really a difference then between breaking up Google Plus, as this is described, and killing it?
Well, I don't think they're going to kill it, or at least not yet, precisely for the reason I said, which is that they do need to know to make their services what they are. They need to know who you are, and Google Plus has been, you know, the Google login, whether you call it Google Plus or something else, has been the thing by which Google knows who you are. It knows who your friends are. It knows what you're interested in and whatnot. And it can serve search results or YouTube, you know, comments or whatever it is in a more targeted way. So I think they will keep it, even though obviously the hope and the goal of competing with Facebook as a full-fledged social network is pretty much gone.
It seems to me that there could be a bit of semantics there, because ultimately when they launched Google Plus, it was they essentially combined something we've all forgotten about called profiles with Google Wave, and they added the Hangouts and a few other things, and then they added amazing photo tools. And now if you break all those things back apart, we're pretty much where we were before Google Plus existed. Yeah, they'll call it Google Plus. It'll be a site. You can post things there. I use Google Plus as a blog. It'll still be a blogging or social networking site. But really, it was the integration of disparate components that made up Google Plus initially with a slick design. And then the disintegration of those brings us pretty much back to where we started before. Now, let's shift gears a little bit. Now, Pichai told you that Android is closing the gap on app monetization, a big, big issue for app developers, of course. What did he tell you about closing the gap with Apple on developers making money for Android?
Sure. As you know, Android has a much bigger market share than the iPhone globally, yet revenue for developers has not kept up. And for the first time, Pichai said that Google distributed $7 billion to developers between February of last year and February of this year. By comparison, Apple recently said that in 2014, they distributed $10 billion to developers. So, you know, Apple's clearly still ahead, but Google is closing the gap. They're in the same sort of ballpark in terms of, you know, if you think about it in orders of magnitude. And as in addition to that, you know, Google's been struggling with mobile and mobile revenue, and they announced it, something that could be quite significant, which is that they will start using search ads on searches performed on the Google Play Store. So app developers will be able to advertise themselves and make themselves discovered by users. And, you know, Google knows this very well. This is search advertising. It worked on web search. It's the most profitable business on the web, the most profitable big business on the web. And now they're bringing it to the App Store. One venture capitalist said the opportunity might be in the billions of dollars. So this is a potentially significant new initiative that will move the needle on Google revenue.
But will, and Miguel, I'm really interested in this question too, what you just brought up, which is, you know, will it be enough? Will moving search advertising to mobile happen, or will the revenue from that happen fast enough to catch up with what's being lost in search advertising on the web as users move more and more away from the traditional desktop web?
You know, that's the big question for Google right now. The transition to mobile, even though they own the world's biggest mobile platform, it hasn't been kind to Google, and they are trying to find, you know, it hasn't been a disaster either. There are many places where they're doing quite well, you know, in search, web search on mobile and YouTube and video ads and whatnot. But it is, you know, the mobile so far has proven a more challenging environment for Google to monetize its services than the PC. And, you know, every bit helps. Sundar Pichai said this initiative to put ads in you know, Google Play searches helps. It's not the one and only thing. So, you know, we'll see over time how well this transition proceeds.
And we're going to be talking more about that in detail in our next story. Miguel Heft is at Forbes.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at mhelft. Thank you so much for joining us, Miguel.
Thank you.
Google plans to start showing promoted Android apps in the Google Play Store, as we mentioned. Until now, Google Play was an ad-free site. Joining us to talk about this is Brad Linder, who's the editor of Lilliputing. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
Since Google takes a 30% cut of app revenue, would you consider these essentially house ads, or do developers actually have to buy and pay for the advertising?
Well, at this point is a pilot program that's going to be launching in the next couple of weeks. And from what we understand, TechCrunch reported earlier today that there might not actually be any money changing hands during the pilot program. Eventually, though, it is going to be the sort of thing where if advertisers or if app makers feel that they're not getting the same sort of promotion in the App Store that they want from organic search results, they'll be able to pay to be at the top of those results.
So, Brad, I mean, same question that Miguel and I just talked about, which is what is the promise in terms of revenue for Google as they try and figure out what to do when people move away from the web?
Well, as more and more people are using apps and mobile devices are really sort of lending themselves towards that, Google, is always looking for different ways to make money. And most of that money in the past has been made through search. So Android is a platform that was really developed as this open source software that any company can use. And Google doesn't make money by licensing Android software per se. Instead, it makes its money when people are using Android to search the web, download apps, to do these other things. So traditionally, as you guys mentioned, Google has made some money off of app sales by taking a 30% cut. Part of that actually goes to hosting all of the services that Google offers. But clearly, that's a revenue maker for Google. In the blog post announcing the fact that they're going to be doing advertising today, they really sort of pushed it as a way for app makers to promote discovery of their applications. And they pointed out that they have paid $7 billion to app makers. Now, that means that since they're taking a 30% cut, Google has brought in probably about $10 billion from app sales. So this could be another source of revenue for the company. It's not really clear how much of a source of revenue it's going to be. But as Google looks for ways to make more money off of YouTube, off of Google Search, as advertisers are spending less money, this could be a way to convince advertisers to spend more money advertising with Google.
There's promise and peril in all this, of course. If developers who have better products and more popular products tend to have more money, they'll be more likely to advertise. And so in a sense, it could help people find better apps. On the other hand, it could confuse people and make people think that the advertising search results are actually legitimate search results. Do you think that they're going to strike this tone, do it right? And do you think that they are working on that and cognizant of that potential problem?
I'd be surprised if they weren't thinking about it. Google, of course, for years has been a company that's been known for providing high quality search results in a sort of sparse environment where you have a big white page with a couple of links. And then at the top of that page, you'll sometimes see paid sponsored advertisements. So people can pay to basically show up above the organic search results. So in order to not really annoy their users, the people who are conducting those searches, they've always had to walk that fine line. Now, the question is, when you're looking at a small screen device, when you have a smartphone, there's not a lot of space on here. So, when you conduct that search, if there's only room for a couple of results to pop up, and the top one, as in this video that we're looking at right here, shows that there's an ad, and then below that you see things that aren't ads, are people going to get annoyed if too much of that screen real estate is taken up with something that they might not feel is the best result, but just the paid result? So that's definitely probably why they're that's probably one of the reasons why they're rolling this out as a pilot program first, to see how users react. A limited number of users are going to be seeing this at first. A limited number of advertisers are going to be accepted into the program before it rolls out to a wider audience.
Sounds really interesting. I can't wait to see the pilot, and we'll see if they actually do it for real. Brad Linder's at bradlinder.net, and you can follow him on Twitter at Brad Linder. Thanks for joining us today, Brad.
Thanks for having me, and you can find more at lilliputing.com as well.
Google launched a new Android for Work program yesterday. The initiative promises to bring better security to Android by offering a secure area inside Android phones and tablets that can be managed by company policies. Users would be able to switch between work versions and personal versions of email and other apps. The company-managed work versions of those apps would live inside a suitcase icon on the Android desktop. This sounds like a great idea, Elise Hugh. Basically, it solves that problem, or theoretically solves the problem, where you don't want to have a work issued phone and also a personal phone and carry two phones around. You want a single phone, but also the company needs to manage and have policies associated with their secure apps that they have. I don't see any downside to this, and I think they're going to get a lot of traction with this. What do you think?
Well, yeah, we'll see how adoption goes, because a lot of companies have already sort of gotten into one system or one way of doing things. So, but Android's badge of honor is that it's open, and companies, what they love is systems that are more closed. And so this kind of splits the baby a little bit, and could be a win-win.
The Lollipop version of Android was specially built for this type of functionality. So the main version will be for Android Lollipop, but there'll be a separate version for non-Lollipop versions or older versions of Android. And so you have to know what kind of, you know, operating system is running on your Android phone to know which version of this that you would use. Now, they've got partners like LG, Sony, and HTC, Box, Salesforce, SAP, Citrix, VMware, and the biggest surprise is BlackBerry. BlackBerry makes its own version of something like this and enables you to do something similar, but BlackBerry is actually being a partner in all of this. And the companies Woolworth and Pearson have already been testing this product, Android for Work. Well, the Samsung Focus blog Sam Mobile, The Samsung Focus blog Sam Mobile published very clear pictures today that appear to be leaked images of the Galaxy S6 Edge sitting next to the Galaxy S6. The phone Samsung is expected to unveil on Sunday in Barcelona before Mobile World Congress. I will be there, and we're going to get a really good look at these. And that looks super legit, if you ask me. Now, if these pictures are real, they confirm the rumors about both devices, with one interesting exception. The Galaxy S6 Edge does have curved screen displays that appear on the left and right edges of the phone, but unlike the rumors and the current Galaxy Note Edge, the Edge displays offers an option for continuation of the main screen. So if you look at this picture, you can see that the main regular screen actually spills over the sides and over to the edge. You can't do that with the current Edge device. So that basically gives you a bigger screen. As the NPR's new Samsung expert, Alicia, what do you think of these phones? Do you think these are going to knock people's socks off and give them a reason to switch from the iPhone?
Well, it sounds like you're going to get to see one before I do, unless I pay a visit to Samsung headquarters as soon as I get there. So I'd love for you to check it out and tell the viewers and myself, one of your viewers, about how this phone behaves and looks and feels, because I got to figure out what phone I'm going to be carrying around in Korea.
Yeah, and Samsung might be a good choice. I actually have to admit that I'm super tempted by that Edge device. I love the idea of the curved glass, and I like the idea, especially now that I've seen this one, of, you know, you have an option for something that is a bigger screen, or you can have a unique display which has its own API, apparently, and you can have all kinds of special things running on the edges. I just think that's really cool, and, you know, it's pretty interesting technology to have a touch display that actually curves around to the side. Well, every few years, Microsoft illustrates its vision of the future with well-produced videos they call Productivity Future Visions. I love these things. They've only done two or three ever, and they just released a new one. It depicts the world of technology in about 5 or 10 years and features flexible displays, ultra-thin tablets, advanced 3D printers, and, of course, holograms. Let's take a look at Microsoft's new Future Vision video. So we see a scuba diver diving through kelp, and suspended in mid-water are details about the plants and presumably animals that she is encountering. And she's doing sampling and interesting science. And again, it's like augmented reality. Things are floating in the water in front of her as she's scuba diving around. And then, dun-dun-dun, we back up, and it's a giant screen in a classroom, and a teacher is actually showing this scuba diver on a screen. And the kids are all, this is the most unrealistic part, is the kids are all very well behaved. In the classroom, they've got a really good 3D printer with a 3D printing full color starfish, super thin touch tablets, super thin big screens. You know, this is the thing that people don't take into account, I think, when they predict the future, is how inexpensive super high quality, high resolution screens are going to be in 5 or 10 years. They're going to be dirt cheap. Cheap enough for classrooms. That actually looks like a future iMac, actually. All right, so this goes on and on. And you want to spend some quality time with this, because they're just breathtaking videos. And I think that a lot of their ideas for these videos tend to be dead on. They're really smart about it. They have trouble themselves getting these types of
making
ideas.
Making the actual products, right?
Exactly, but they're really good at making the videos. All right, Elise, well, here's a story I added to the rundown just for you. Korea's SK Telecom, which offers an unbelievable 300 megabits per second download speeds on its Seoul LTE network, is partnering with Nokia Networks to create new antennas that doubles that speed. Companies are going to demonstrate 600 megabits per second downloads to smartphones. The technology is called 4x4 MIMO, and of course MIMO stands for multiple input, multiple output, and it's not expected to be commercially available for a long time. So I'm sorry, Elise, you're going to have to squeeze by with 300 megabits per second.
That's still much, much faster. I don't know how many orders of magnitude faster than my 7 megabits per second.
Yeah. I mean, I'm super thrilled that at my house I get, on a good day, I get like 50 megabits per second download. And it's really fast. I mean, it's good. It's really good. And that's a landline connection connected through Ethernet and the whole bit. And I just can't imagine 300 megabits per second downloads to a smartphone. That is just mind-blowing. You're really going to enjoy that.
I'm going to be all caught up on all my favorite shows.
Exactly. You can watch House of Cards in like 5 minutes.
Right.
Incredible. Well, we told you Tuesday about Google's deal with SoftCard. The deal enabled U.S. carriers to pre-install Google Wallet on all their Android phones running Android KitKat and above. Now we're hearing that the SoftCard NFC Wallet app, which had both Android and Windows Phone versions, will be killed and all existing wallets will be terminated. It all sounds very, very bloody. This is especially bad news for Windows Phone users because while they're losing the SoftCard Wallet app, they won't be gaining the Google Wallet capability as all the Android users will. SoftCard used to be named ISIS, but they changed their name so people didn't think they were a bunch of terrorists.
Man, I feel so bad for all the companies and other entities that were named ISIS. There was one yoga pants company that was called ISIS for Women. Ooh, ooh.
Yeah, yeah. That's not. ISIS, the Middle Eastern ISIS, is not going to be buying those. I can guarantee you that. Well, we told you on Tuesday about last week about LG's fancy new smartwatch called the Urbane. In that segment, we said the watch was just like the LG G Watch, but with a metal casing. In other words, that it was an Android Wear watch. It turns out that LG plans to ship two versions of the Urbane watch, one running Android Wear, and a second one that supports fast LTE connectivity. And here's the surprising part. It's powered by a proprietary operating system developed by LG that nobody's heard of. It doesn't appear to be WebOS, which LG has a license for. The company claims that the watch is the world's first LTE smartwatch and that you'll be able to make calls on it without a smartphone. The watch will also be packed with sensors and will come with an app that analyzes your golf swing. And we expect to hear more about this at Mobile World Congress next week and also when Elise Hu buys one. And she's going to tell us about how her golf swing is doing with this watch.
I actually have a pretty good swing. I have a pretty good short game. You know, I was varsity golf.
Really?
So I can't wait to check this out. I'll have to go to the future museums. So LG and Samsung in Korea, in Seoul, actually have their own museums where you can kind of check out what they're working on and the concepts they're working on for the future. And so I might be able to get my hands on one of these.
That's cool. Yeah, let us know when you do that. We'll have you on the show. In government crackdown news, under constant attack by European regulators, Google is circling the wagons. The company has combined its two European regional divisions in order to simplify both business, but mostly its relationships with European policymakers and regulators. Google's regional headquarters, and this, of course, includes the Middle East is in addition to Europe, their headquarters will remain in Dublin, Ireland. In hiring, firing, and poaching news, Jay Carney, of all people, who worked as President Obama's press secretary for more than 3 years, has been hired by Amazon as VP of Corporate Affairs. His role appears to be a cross between public relations chief and corporate lobbyist. Carney starts Monday. Elise Hu, this is really, you know, Jeff Bezos is buying Washington. He's buying the government piece by piece. He already owns the Washington Post.
That's right. And then this continues the trend of former Obama, very close Obama aides joining major tech companies. This follows David Plouffe, who is now, I can't remember his particular title, but some sort of major dog at Uber. And so now Jay Carney's joining Amazon. And so I'll be interested to see at the end of the Obama administration who else leaves for Silicon Valley companies.
That's a great title. I like that title, Major Dog.
Major dog.
All right. Well, in the Department of Transportation.
D-A-W-G.
Yeah, okay. In the Department of Transportation, as everyone knows, the CEO of both Tesla and SpaceX wants someone to build a transportation system called a Hyperloop. Elon Musk envisions sending people through a tube at 800 miles an hour. Now a company called Hyperloop Transportation Technologies is building an actual test track in Central California in a place called Quay Valley, which is about halfway between L.A. and San Francisco. Construction for the $100 million project will be raised by an IPO later this year, apparently, if it's successful. What do you think about this, Elise? Do you think this Hyperloop thing is ever going to happen? It sounds pretty far-fetched, and it seems like the regulations would be pretty huge. But again, who would have thought that SpaceX or Tesla would have happened either?
Yeah, exactly. And so just to be clear, so this new company, this Hyperloop Transportation Technologies company, is going to essentially be competing against Elon Musk. Is this a race to get to the Hyperloop?
I don't think Elon Musk himself is actually building a Hyperloop, is he? I mean, I think he's been trying to get other people to do it. I think he's got his hands full with his space program and his electric car. And soon he'll have to be competing with Apple, which is never a pleasant thing, in the electric car racket. But yeah, this is another company. I'm sure they worship the ground that Elon Musk drives on, but he is not involved in this company, to the best of my knowledge, officially.
Right, because when the first Hyperloop news came out, I was reading that Musk was actually interested in testing Hyperloop concepts in Texas, and so I assume these are sort of separate entities and separate ideas going.
They can't do it in Texas. They don't have the space. There's no space in Texas. It's too crowded. Well, in news you can lose, speculation is rampant about just how much money Apple plans to charge for its 18-karat gold-plated edition version of the Apple Watch. Estimates I've heard range from $3,000 to $20,000 per watch. But if that's not expensive enough for you, a company called Brick with two Ks today announced a line of 30 different customized versions of the watch that will cost as much as $75,000 per watch. You can pre-order it today. The blinged out Apple Watches will offer improvements on the wristband and watch casing, like 24 karat yellow gold, 18 karat pink gold, and 950 platinum, and also, of course, diamonds everywhere. And if you're going to pre-order a watch for $75,000 before the Apple Watch even ships, give me a call. I have a bridge you might be interested in. What do you think? Elise, I think we talked about this before I asked you if you're going to get the Apple Watch. I'm predicting that you're going to get it. What do you think?
Well, it depends on how swayed I am by Samsung and LG when I'm out there, right? So, because I think that there is a lot of sort of cultural and social pressure when you're inside major cities in Korea to actually be carrying devices and using devices that are made by their big Chaebo technology companies. And so I've been trying to decide whether I'm going to kind of switch over from my Apple products and use some mobile products that are by my new Korean-based companies.
Or if you're going to represent, you know what I'm saying? But actually, one of the big surprising aspects of Apple's incredible success in the fourth quarter was incredible success in Korea.
So lots and lots
of Koreans are suddenly really embracing the iPhones. I think they really love those gigantic phones. And I think one of the things holding Apple back in the phone market in Korea was the fact that iPhones were so tiny when they had all these homegrown LG and Samsung phones that were much bigger. But now that the iPhone is large, it's much, much more popular with Korean buyers. So who knows? You might blend in better than you think with an Apple Watch. We'll see. Well, we got a wrap up for you in just a minute. But first, let's talk about Gazelle, the place to sell your used gadgets. You know, money is good. And if you've got a device sitting around, that's like money in the bank, except it's not in the bank. It's sitting in a drawer collecting dust and losing value. So you want to take that phone or that tablet or even that Apple laptop or desktop and sell it to Gazelle, and they'll give you great money for it. You just go to the website. There's the website if you're looking at the video version. It's a very easy-to-use, intuitive site. I don't have to tell you how to use it, but it's simply just go there, choose the gadget, indicate what it is, what the condition is, and they'll send you a box, throw the device in the box, and off it goes, and you get paid fast. You can also buy a pre-owned device from Gazelle. It's a great way to get a better device for the same money as you'd buy with new. And of course, the certified like new category of devices from Gazelle is exactly like a brand new phone. It's just a better price. You get, and when you sell to Gazelle, you get paid in cash. Payment is fast. Just, you got to do business with Gazelle. It's the way to buy and sell phones, tablets, and more. So find out what your iPhone is worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out. Our TNT fan of the day is Jay Sikorsky. He posted this picture on Twitter, which he took while watching Tech News Today on a tablet during his commute between London and Edinburgh. And here it is. We're going to put that on the screen. There it is. There we are on the flight. And that looks like, is that an iPhone? An iPad? I can't tell. That's some kind of tablet with a keyboard attachment. And he's positioned it so that the person sitting next to him can't see it. We almost had another viewer. What are you going to do? Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Elise, we are certainly going to miss you, but before we send you off, let's watch a really fun music video. Now, can you tell us who made this video?
Sure. We have a science desk his title is reporter, but he's also an animator and a songwriter and an illustrator. His name is Adam Cole. He has talent to burn. And we were doing a brainstorm about going to Korea and what stories I was going to work on. We were talking a lot about K-pop culture. And so he decided to challenge himself to write a K-pop style ballad. So real bubblegummy with a white man rap in the middle of it.
Nice.
Using only words from a Korean English dictionary.
Brilliant. Okay, let's roll the video. I can smell the Korean bubblegum.
Elise goes east, disembarking from the district. Took a little while just to work out the logistics. Now she's got a visa, going to Korea, the land of morning calm. Whoa-oh. You know she got the gift of gab.
Yes, she does.
But she's missing the vocabulary.
I don't know a lick of Korean.
But I use one to write this song. I never say you're all too easy.
Speak Texan.
That's right.
Elise came east like a bat out of Texas. Reckless, she eats breaking news for breakfast. Check this, my girl used to kick it on all deck, crushing that beat while she's sipping on Malbec. Elise goes east, yeah, she's doing it again. Gonna open up a bureau like she's searching for pens. Hey, sister, soul sister, telling DCC, yeah, hi to Hong Kong. I think that's how you say Korea.
Soul
she
sister.
Got that smile, she got mad styles. She gotta take a trip 7,000 miles. First free, say cheese, two fingers for peace. Mental gears are greased, she's a beast. Elise goes east. I think I got the translation.
Oh, no.
But not the pronunciation. So this song won't be that helpful if you're trying to learn Korean.
I never say yo to you, Elise. Banyan hanida to the
Elise goes east.
This guy's incredible. I want this to be my ringtone. I have to figure out how to download it from YouTube and then make it my ringtone.
Yeah.
Perfect. Nobody's ever done anything like this for me. I was so moved and it's so hilarious. I was both sort of crying tears of being moved and touched and crying tears of laughter. So,
yeah.
But yeah, so we head out on Sunday and I'll try and pop in on the show now and again, especially with updates on my new Samsung watch and
Great.
My curved screen Samsung Galaxy 6. So
wonderful. Well, you're welcome anytime, of course. Your co-anchoring up to now has been fantastic, and you've got a lot of fans on the Twit Network. So thank you so much. Have a fantastic move, and we're really excited for you. This is going to be quite an adventure, and so thanks again for everything, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks so much, Mike, and to the whole Twit family.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on YouTube. Just go to youtube.com/technewstoday. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And you can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. If you're ever in California, come on in and watch us live. You can also follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. Come hang out with us in our Google Plus community. Just search Google Plus for Tech News Today. And you can follow me personally on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/Mike.Elgin. And let us know what you think. Send an email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW and leave a message. Also, don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight. And every weeknight, I'll be hosting tonight's show. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.